Ladies and gentlemen, I think it is time to start the morning session. We have four exciting talks. The first one will be Jaroslav Cerkovniak. He's also advisor of the program committee and from the UCLA. Please, Jaroslav, go ahead.
Thank you, Garrett. Rembert emphasized to me that it's customary to start the talk by thanking the organizers. Well, I thank Rembert for organizing this conference. I'm not sure I should be too grateful because I was not invited to this conference. Rather, I was pushed in as the last-minute substitute. And Rembert's excuse was, "Wow, you're an advisor for the program. All other advisors already give a talk, so why don't you give a talk?" So thank you, Rembert.
My pleasure.
All right. I will talk about magnetic vortices, the transport, and the out-of-equilibrium energetics. So the subtitle is Transport and Energy Storage Based on Topological Textures. The work was initiated by together with Sik Won, my former postdoc, a couple years ago. And currently, GSO is the main player. So G is here. He's a student at UCLA. Feel free to discuss with him this topic. He's going to be around for the conference. All right. So what do I mean by that? We can start with some simple analogies. Perhaps the simplest one is hydrodynamic flow. We can discuss it employing some kind of circuit-like language along the lines of Bernoulli's law. So what's important for me is this kind of biasing of hydrodynamic flows where gravity is used to do work. So tilting one end of a tube, the flow in the absence for starters of any additional pressures, the flow would be driven by the gravity. So that's perhaps the simplest example of when external work is driving some kind of dynamics in an active circuit, in this case a hydrodynamic circuit. So work here is done by gravity, maybe external pressures, that's what drives the flow. There is a conservation law for fluid mass. So the theory here would be based on stating the conservation law, invoking the energetic considerations, and then, of course, there's a lot of complexity that has to do with various nuances, various regimes of flow. There could be laminar flow with small biases, turbulent flow. Constitutive relations could be simple in linear response, but ultimately we have turbulence, chaos, and all sorts of nonlinear dynamic complications. Another example more familiar to this community would concern electronic circuits. Again, let me think of it using similar language. So we have a diffusive, let's say a diffusive conductor. Electrons or holes can move through it, so it could be a semiconducting wire. Now, from now on, I will be shifting focus to electronic phenomena. So the work, nothing is really going to be mechanically moving. The geometry is fixed. So the work now on the electrons moving through the circuit is performed by some external batteries. So I have a left battery that biases the left end with respect to the ground, a separate right battery. So the left end experiences work, or electrons hopping on and off the left end experience work by the battery. That is given by electron charge times voltage per a single electron. Okay? So, again, the game is very, very similar. We start with a conservation law, with a continuity equation for charge. We involve the work. The amount of work is an input in the theory. That's a bias that drives transport. It's kind of simple at that level. we have the work controlled separately at the two ends, and it's of course the difference between these two electrochemical potentials that might drive some steady flow of electron charge from one side to another. And then, again, linear response could be quite simple, but in general, there could also be all sorts of complex issues that have to do with nonlinearities, maybe some quantum corrections to transport, whatnot. Okay. So, building up on these analogies, the third example that is very similar, but now bringing us to the realm of spintronics, concerns spin circuits like this. And if you remember the last two talks of yesterday, now this example is in the vein of those discussions. So suppose we have a spin conductor, could be a Fermi liquid, could be a ferromagnet, anti-ferromagnet, or something more complex. But let's just suppose that there is a spin symmetry axis polarized oriented out of plane, so the spin out of plane is conserved, at least approximately. So we have some kind of at least approximate continuity equation for spin polarized out of plane. The question is now, what would be a natural battery? Okay, in one example we had gravity, that was very simple and natural. In the second example we had batteries that drove electrical flows. What would be a natural battery that sort of generically drives spin flows? And by now it's established that at least one natural example of such a battery is simply coherently precessing a magnet. That precession could be driven by FMR resonance. Okay, so the left battery could be a magnet attached at the left end, steadily precessing at some cone angle, some solid angle, omega, some frequency, lowercase omega. Likewise, we have coherently processing magnet with a different frequency. Then it's easy to convince yourself that the work done by such a coherently processing object would translate into the electrochemical potential of H bar omega at the respective ends per transfer of spin 1 across the interface. Yeah, yeah. So those are the things we can start adding later. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So let's first start with idealized treatment, so the risk conservation law. That's how you realize the battery. What's that? Then the spin diffusion length would be infinite, and then in some idealized limit, this could be very much like a diffusive conductor of charge. And then you know, you start adding relaxation, etc. At the interface, however, when the exchange interactions are strong, and this physics, this battery effect happens at atomistic length scales, in many cases of interest, you could neglect spin relaxation. So this argument of thinking of a precessing object as a condensate, magnon condensate, setting the chemical potential of magnets at that interface at this level is a good argument, you know, is a good approximation. But then, of course, when spins are injected, you have to start including relaxation, and various standard issues arise. Okay, so again, you have some constitutive relations, relaxation, spin diffusion lengths arising as a result. You could have other regimes of spin transport. It could be spin superfluid, as discussed in the evening yesterday. So, you know, so then, you know, various possibilities. Okay, I'm saying this is just a framework, and then, of course, a lot of wealth of possibilities for exploring spin transport follow. But that's not the topic of my talk. This is just a quick reminder of established facts. Okay, so in this talk, I want to discuss vorticity as an object that carries a conserved quantity. So I want to play the same game I want to construct a theory for transport of vorticity. We'll discuss why it is may or may not be interesting later. Let's first do it. I want to figure out a way to bias such circuits energetically. So in some sense, I want to be able to apply work on the vortex injection at an end of a circuit, or the two ends of a circuit. I want to be able to measure the outflow of vorticity induced in this energetic fashion. So basically, I want to proceed just inspired by the success of Bernoulli's theory, Kirchhoff's laws, spintronics. I want to proceed in the same fashion and see how far we can get. So that's the motivation. Vorticity is just an example of a topological texture. It's an archetypal example with many realizations in physics, in bosonic fluids, in magnets, ferromagnets, antiferromagnets. So for me, let's just suppose that it's a novel transport carrier, maybe ultimately building block for some functional circuitries, developing things in analogy to spintronics. So the first questions that come to mind that I would raise could be of this nature. Can vorticity flow in insulating magnetic films as a conserved hydrodynamic quantity in some kind of circuit setting? So I have a battery that drives it. I have a way to detect the vorticity outflow. Can it be controlled electrically? Namely, can I control the energetics of the vorticity electrically? And other obvious experimental signatures, maybe applications, or in general, like what sorts of interesting aspects this might lead to, fundamentally or in practice. All right. So before digging in, let me remind you, these types of pictures, you know, if you have a superfluid, in a rotating bucket, that rotation in equilibrium, in a steady state, could control equilibrium vorticity of the interior. Okay, so in the absence of rotation, it's a neutral superfluid. There are no vortices, rotating the bucket, we can control vorticity. So in some sense, maybe such rotational dynamics could be used as a battery. Okay, if it controls the equilibrium vorticity density, perhaps I could reformulate it in terms of controlling chemical potential of vorticity. So maybe that's the way to go. And by the way, similar things happen on astrophysical scales in superfluid neutron stars, apparently. But I'm not going to get into that. So building on this analogy, let us suppose that perhaps we can start with a magnetic film. Let's take it to be easy plane magnets. So vortices would be natural excitations in that film. Let us first suppose that we're driving an electrical current. We're able to attach, and this is just a Duncan experiment for a second, we're attaching a metallic wire on the side and driving electrical current, a circulating electrical current. Can that mimic, you know, the action of a rotating bucket? Okay, maybe in equilibrium there is essentially no vorticity. The magnet could be more or less uniform in the interior. Would such electrical current circulating around that patch of magnetic film be able to control the vorticity? Okay, so that's the question. First of all, by simple symmetry analysis, you could show that you could go backwards and ask what are the symmetry requirements for this to happen, and you could convince yourself that a normal metal wire would not do the trick, but a ferromagnetic metallic wire polarized out of plane, from the symmetry point of view, is what you need to inject vorticity in the system. So it's different from the symmetries of the rotating superfluid bucket because the spatial reflection symmetries of a magnetic vortex are slightly different from a bosonic vortex because magnetic order parameter is a pseudo vector. All right. So let's neglect all of that. Okay. Yeah, so let me focus on 1 over c to limit of 1 over c going to 0. So let me neglect all the dipole effects and just the standard. Just exchange interaction, right. Just a plain exchange, no spin orbit, just plain exchange. And I'm going to, microscopically, I would invoke some spin transfer torque at the boundary due to interaction of electrons circulating in this metal with the magnetic film. Sorry. Yeah, thank, but a good point, yeah.
So in relation with blowing bubbles, like Wang Zhang has been doing?
No, not that immediately comes to my mind.
It's a dynamic one, right?
Yeah, well, so my claim is that in a steady state, this will kind of look like the rotating bucket of a superfluid. So the torques will be such that vortices will go in or will be sucked out, depending on the chirality of the circulating current. Okay, so if that works, then we can cut this circuit open, and we can go back to the kinds of examples like we discussed in the beginning of the talk. So we can consider a two-terminal circuit for vorticity flow. The electrical current at the left sets the chemical potential of vorticity. Let's just suppose it might be happening. I'll dig into details on the next slide. So let's suppose this electrical current sets the chemical potential of vorticity. Here, microscopically, it will have to do with the spin transfer torque arising at the interface. So if the chemical potential at this end now is different from the chemical potential at that end, the vortices will flow. Okay, in the simplest regime, it could be analogous to a two-component vortex plasma, very much like a diffusive semiconducting flow of vortices along this film. So that would be above Kosellecz-Stalwitz temperature for the experts. All right. Now, I want to emphasize that unlike spintronic currents, vorticity is really a conserved quantity. Okay, there's nothing on the right-hand side. There's no relaxation of vorticity. It's a fundamentally conserved quantity, irrespective of what the Hamiltonian is. And that conservation law is rooted in topology. So it's a kind of topological hydrodynamics, a topological conservation law, irrespective of the symmetries of the problem. You could check it yourself that defining vorticity density in this fashion, M is the order parameter, is a vectorial, a pseudo-vectorial order parameter. In a ferromagnet, it would be local spin density. Without making any assumptions about M, without projecting M on a unit sphere or projecting it onto the easy plane, without making any assumptions about M, so it could, in principle, be even applicable at this level to a simple Heisenberg ferromagnet, substituting this rho into the continuity equation in conjunction with this vorticity fluxes defined as such, you could show that you have a perfect continuity equation. Yeah. Yeah. What's that? Z is, okay, so the coordinate system is like this. So this is x direction, this is y. Z is out of plane. Sorry, this z is a unit vector out of plane. Yeah, that's a normal to the plane in which I define vorticity. Physically, in terms of our torques, that's determined by the magnetization of my contacts. So pointing magnetization of the contacts at a certain plane sets up vorticity hydrodynamics in the plane perpendicular to it. Yeah, absolutely. So if you substitute like a standard vortex or anti-vortex profile, this rho would be essentially a delta function spread over vortex core, positive or negative for vortex or anti-vortex. Okay, question? Okay. Okay, on the next slide. So, you know, these kind of games have already been played with superconducting vortices, so that I just briefly mentioned in the passing. So it's an experimental, this is an experimental picture. I think this is probably a simulation in which a non-local voltage was detected by, was mediated by a vorticity flow along a superconducting wire. So an electrical current was applied in this direction that pushed energetically a vortex flow in the transverse direction, and then this vertex flow induced measurable voltage at those two ends. Now, let's dig into a little bit into details of what's really happening at the boundaries. Okay, so far I just argued based on general principles, symmetry arguments, but does it really happen? Okay, and so what do we stand so far? We have a continuity equation. Now let's work out the boundary conditions. Okay, and then after that, we have to develop some theory for the vorticity flow. So basically, constitutive relations, whatever hydrodynamic theory there is. Okay, so kind of three components. Okay, conservation law, boundary conditions, and then what's really happening in the bulk. So again, thinking really along the same logic as Bernoulli's law, Kirchhoff's law, etc. Okay, so let me take one more step towards microscopics, but still I'm going to argue based on the symmetry arguments. So if you try to construct torque at the boundary, torque exerted by electrical current on magnetic texture in this magnetic, let's say it's a magnetic insulator. So the magnetic texture is parameterized by M. It's a pseudo-vector without any approximations about its magnitude, orientation, whatsoever. Capital M is the magnetization, is the uniform magnetization in the contact. So let's say it's just Z. Okay. The leading order adiabatic, so-called adiabatic, the leading order in a texture gradient, this is the del here stands for the magnetic texture along the interface in the y direction, because that's where the electrical current is flowing. Okay, the spin transfer torque arises from a little bit of a proximity effect between the metallic layer and the non-metallic insulating layer. So the most basic torque that you construct by symmetry at the interface looks like this. And it's isotropic, separately in spin and momentum space, so it does not require microscopic any spin-orbit interactions. So generically, slapping a metallic magnet on the side of an insulating magnet will give rise to this torque. So putting, in other words, putting something like permalloy on the side of something like Yig should generically yield this kind of torque. Eta is a microscopic parameter that parameterizes the strength of this proximity effect. All right, so let's now calculate work done by this torque on some spontaneous fluctuation of vorticity near the interface. Okay, so the rate of the work production by this torque, I can calculate like this. So I should remove this dot here. So the total work is an integral over time, integral over y, the coordinate that parameterizes the position along the interface, and the integrand is the torque times the precessional frequency as a function of position on the insulating side along the interface. So plugging this tau into this expression, we get the following nice result. Well, if we drop, I should really drop this time integral. So it's the rate of the work production. It's given by eta, that's some phenomenological parameter that depends on the properties of the interface, times the triple scalar product between Z, that's the normal to the picture, J, the electrical current, and little j, that's the vorticity current defined like this. Okay, so there is an energetic gain by vortex flow transverse to the applied electrical current. So it's kind of like the Magnus force, or like the force by the superflow on vortices in a superconductor. Okay, so this is our energetic bias. Okay, so that kind of completes the argument. Of course, the next natural step would be, you know, one can calculate this eta for various models, and of course, experimentalists should measure it. So the usual, you know, the usual game as was played concerning spin transfer torques in metal magnet interfaces, except that this is spin transfer torque between two types of magnets, metallic magnet on the one side and insulating magnet. So slightly unconventional kind of spin transfer torque, but not really too crazy, not too unconventional. And whatever physics you know, that works out, as we discussed, for the injection of vorticity, the reciprocal of that, the Onzaga reciprocal, will act as the detection mechanism. So when this vorticity is injected, let's say at the left end, we could keep the circuit open. So no electrical current that results in an effective zero chemical potential of vorticity at the right end, while the vorticity chemical potential at the left end is controlled by this warp. So that literally directly translates into the chemical potential that is for us, namely eta times J will be the chemical potential of vorticity, because that's the work that the torque does on an injection of a single vortex. And by Onzaga reciprocity, we can measure the electromotive force associated with vortices coming out, and that could be expressed in terms of the same eta parameter. Okay. So that's kind of that's sort of the main idea. It would be, you know, one example, at least conceptually, where it would be interesting to realize such circuits would be in the vicinity of a KT transition for magnetic vortices. So below KT temperature, the vortices would bind and yield a vorticity insulator. Above KT temperature, we would have essentially vorticity metal, a diffusive two-component plasma. So in this this example, temperature would be could act as a switch between insulating and metallic behavior of the vorticity. So, but okay, in the next remaining few minutes, let's take a step back and just ask, you know, some general questions. Well, okay, that's fine. Why should it be interesting or useful? Okay, so first of all, to summarize, you know, this is the circuit, the main idea that we are proposing. So the battery effect is realized by electrical current flowing tangentially, as I've discussed, which injects vortices, anti-vortices, overall imbalance of vorticity, according to this chemical potential bias is given by essentially eta times electrical current density on this side. We could apply also bias at the other end. You could think of this electrical current as biasing the chemical potential with respect to vacuum, which is grounded. Okay? So why vorticity transport could be interesting? First of all, the conservation law is robust, unlike spin conservation law. So that ensures generally truly long-range transport. Intricate relation to winding. So we can use this vorticity flow to wind up superfluid-like textures, so basically the winding textures in the transverse direction. And I'll argue on a slide in a minute, that could be used as kind of a new approach to energy storage. Basically, with the energy stored in the persistent superflow associated with the winding, which is wound by the vorticity transport. And we have wealth of insulating room temperature magnetic materials, particularly antiferromagnets, you know, which gives a really large phase space for material properties, different regimes of this physics, which some of which might even end up being useful in practice. Okay, I want to emphasize that the idea, the way I described it, works equally well for the vorticity defined in terms of magnetic order parameter or anti-ferromagnetic order parameter, nail order parameter. And you realize immediately why that is so, because both the vorticity density and vorticity flows were quadratic in the other parameter. So loosely speaking, for the two magnetic sublattices, these effects just add up. So it works just as well for anti-ferromagnets as it does for ferromagnets. So one of the last points I want to make is concerning using vorticity flow to control the winding. If we go to the Corbino geometry, so if we turn our circuit into the Corbino geometry, the electrical currents, applied electrical currents are circulating like this, let's say on the interior of this magnetic annulus, which controls vorticity flow in and out. This vorticity flow in and out, on the other hand, winds up or down a superfluid-like or XY texture around the circumference. When you turn off this the bias that drives vorticity flow, that superfluid texture might stay there for a long time. It's a persistent effect. It's really, in this regime, it's really truly superfluid, namely, there's no energy dissipation associated with this winding. It's just an energetically metastable state that stays there forever. It stores energy. Ultimately, it unwinds by phase slips, so that the rate of the phase slips has to be controlled. Okay, namely, for example, if we can control conductivity of vorticity, for example, by going across the KT temperature, we can drive this vorticity flow on the metallic side of the transition, so that would wind things up around the circumference, and then we can go below KT temperature, freeze the vorticity flow, fixing the winding texture, basically stopping the phase slips, and using this as energy storage. Okay, that's the idea. And the final bit I wanted to convey is that this whole story go pretty much without any change works out in the extreme quantum regime. Namely, I could formulate this whole story on a quantum mechanical spin lattice. The vorticity quantum mechanically is defined like this on a plaquette in terms of spins at the corners of the plaquette. Vorticity flux is defined like this. This time derivative stands simply for the commutator between the operator and the Hamiltonian, according to the Heisenberg equation of motion. So we have a quantum mechanical conservation law. In this paper, we've constructed Kubo formalism for current correlator that brings this story into the realm of quantum materials. So then the questions like, how does the quantum statistics of vortices affect transport? So that's the question that was prominently discussed last week in the program by Oleg Chernyshov. And that brings also this idea into the realm of particle-vortex duality as a direct experimental transport probe of the superfluidity, of the purported superfluidity of vorticity near the superfluid insulator quantum critical point. All right, so some take-home messages, and still have plenty of time for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this intriguing talk. I'm sure there are many questions. Okay, so this was the first one in the back.
Yeah, so what about boundary conditions, and one more question that you have the higher equation.
Can you speak up a little bit?
So I can hit the microphone.
Oh, microphone. You can be the microphone boy.
Yeah, so I just wanted to ask you about the boundary conditions again. And also one more question is that, do you have an Euler equation, a nonlinear Euler equation for vorticity transport? Because most of it is just written in terms of continuity equation.
Yeah, so there is no Euler equation. I mean, there's no Galilean invariance, and the constitutive relations and things like that are very different from you know, hydrodynamics of water or a Galilean invariant fluid. There is nevertheless continuity equation, but the rest of the story would have to be developed on the case-by-case basis for, you know, given material, etc. But there are no Galilean invariants. In some special cases, there could be Lorentz invariance or approximate Lorentz invariance, or maybe some kind of features, depending also on the quality of the material. But generally speaking, especially if you have impurities, It's nothing of the sort of Navier-Stokes type of aspects. The boundary conditions, what about them? Well, the boundary conditions, so physically, you have a metal on the side carrying electrical current. Microscopically, so let's say mechanically, everything is fixed, there are no stresses. I'm also neglecting sort of electromagnetic effects, Faraday effects, things like that. So let's say ascending C to infinity, as Leonid pointed out. Okay, so it's all in the realm of exchange, essentially exchange physics, which is definitely dominant at the interface, at the decent magnetic interface. That's sort of the familiar approximation. It's kind of exchange-dominated physics. So we're kind of in the standard regime of the interfacial spin transfer torque. So electrons, what happens microscopically, electrons which are sort of scattering or sort of drifting along this interface, they simultaneously, the proximity effect, so they simultaneously experience some exchange field polarized along capital M and some exchange field polarized along little m. So there's a little bit of frustration. Electrons don't really know which way to orient, so the spin is scattering, undergoing some precessional dynamics combined with some kind of drift transport. As a result, you naturally get this kinds of torques. This is the simplest torque in the limit when M has a very smooth texture. There will be other torques, okay? So there will be other torques, and they'll couple to other degrees of freedom of the magnetic dynamics. But I can usually neglect those because those degrees of freedom are not associated with any continuity equation. So that means there will be just some dissipation, some energy dump near the interface, which ultimately will maybe renormalize the value of this parameter eta concerning long-distance transport of vorticity, but does not change any physics.
Okay, there are also other questions, yeah, so let's give them the opportunity.
So let me, so it's difficult to put the question of continuity again. Can you put that up there? So it's difficult to argue against that since you've written plus 1 minus 1 equal to 0, which is always the case. But what about when M is changing magnitude? So when you actually add the interfaces, when you add the interfaces and you actually connect to the
measurements. That's a very important question. So if you plug in this raw J and this J's.
Well, I can see that it's exactly zero because it's, you take the derivative of one minus the derivative of this.
Well, it's zero because it's topological conservation law.
Just mathematically zero, if you just look at what it is.
Well, it's mathematically zero because of topology.
But I'm saying, does it depend on the fact that M is constant or not?
No.
No, okay.
So it's zero as is without any assumption of M about the magnitude or orientation. So M, like I said, it could be applied to Heisenberg model. It could be applied above TC.
Also in the presence of damping?
It's a topological conservation law, which is like a mathematical statement that's detached from physics. Well, that's a mathematical statement that provides the framework for the theory. It's kind of a nature of the topological conservation laws. We usually learn and teach our students that conservation laws are rooted in symmetries according to Noether's theorem. But there's another class of conservation laws.
Once it goes to zero, for example, when I'm talking about the detection itself, once the M goes to zero, then you're detecting, then you're in trouble.
And this is
what I'm trying to find out.
So if M is identically zero, then everything is identically zero, but because nothing will happen. No, you cannot regenerate it from zero. M is fluctuating. Yeah.
The question is whether this field has singular points.
No. No, I don't care. So I'm assuming, I am assuming that this field is a smooth vectorial field. Yeah, so it could be Heisenberg, easy plane. Usually in XY model.
The question is whether it's zero at some
point. No, but zero to me is not a singularity. That's important. Yeah, to me, zero is not a singularity. So M is an arbitrary vectorial field. It's going to be naturally smooth field in any magnetic material. It's like a spin density. you know, microscopically, it's as, you know, and I can, if you're worried about it, I can go all the way to the atomistic scale, as I showed on the last slide, in which I define it in terms of the operators defined on each site. What do you mean by M is zero? M is a fluctuating quantity, right? It, maybe it averages zero.
I think let's other people give the opportunity to ask questions.
But so long that M has a fluctuating non-zero quantity, we're in business. And any magnetic material, even non-magnetic material, will have some fluctuating spin density. We can go to the paramagnetic regime. It's just if you develop the rest of the theory, the signal will probably be extremely weak because diffusion coefficient will be extremely small. But the framework is still valid.
I guess the answer to Hyro's question might be related with the response coefficient of the, I mean, that basically there would be then some response coefficient between the driving and the actual current. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, this response coefficient might become zero or infinite.
Well, it's
the
eta. So
for systems which are non-magnetic, this eta would be either zero or infinite.
Well,
I guess
if
zero
the capital
case.
M, if this metallic contact is non-magnetic, so if you go above TC, you know, this capital M is zero, sure. By symmetry, the metallic contact has to be ferromagnetic. So if you go above TC of the ferromagnet, you lose the detection probability.
But actually,
it's like blowing up your battery, you know, throwing your iPhone in the toilet. Like, it will stop working, I mean, eventually. It has to be magnetic. Or maybe if you apply magnetic field and use, like, very high spin susceptibility of platinum, you could play along those lines. But also, just by symmetry, you can show that this has to be magnetic. Basically, the magnetic order parameter of the contact defines the plane of the vorticity dynamics.
Actually, I had the question related to the response because you mentioned that you could have in a kind of superfluid response or, I guess, ordinary type of response. And so the question
or
is about
insulating if the vortex
or even line. Yeah, but maybe like resistive. So do you have reactive? So you could have reactive or dissipative responses to your
absolutely.
Vortex flow.
Yeah, it's
so if it's dissipative, where does the heat go? I mean, is it you know? It's kind of like you pass a current through a resistor and it heats this resistor.
It's a diffusive problem. So vortices are diffusive objects. In the simplest case, the dissipation diffusion is a dissipative process. It's just the entropy associated with Brownian motion of these diffusing particles. That's the minimal dissipation. And on top, of course, there's a lot of heating at the contacts probably. But the beauty of this long-range transport is that ultimately, you know, the contacts could be so far away from each other, you know, that in the end you shouldn't worry about them. Like, it becomes kind of bulk physics.
Yeah, but the vortex resistivity would then be higher.
What's that?
Vortex resistivity would be higher.
Sure. Yeah, but linearly, you know, with the lens, okay? But it's the usual thing, you know, even with superconductor, you know, there's always something at the interfaces to really measure zero resistivity. You know, you have to go to long enough systems so you don't worry about Andrei reflection at the contacts and things like that.
I have a question. So let's say in ordinary superconductors, you would like to select to pin the vortices.
Mm-hmm.
So if let's suppose this is a spin superfluid, what would now be better? A spin superfluid with mobile vortices that do the conduction at the long range or actually pinning the vortices?
So this kind of dichotomy between spin superfluidity and vorticity dynamics, it's like the you know, the correspondence between or the competition between mass superfluidity and the vortex dynamics in the bosonic liquids.
Mm-hmm.
So, namely, vortex dynamics is parasitical to mass flow, same here. So, you know, the regimes in which vortices are most mobile, that's when the superfluidity doesn't work, or if you try to induce it, it will quickly relax by phase slips mediated by vortices. Okay, so that's the main trick. You know, we're suggesting to play with the topological energy storage.
Right.
So when we turn off vorticity conductivity, let's say, for example, going below KT temperature, that's when the superfluidity works and could carry energy for a long time, kind of persistently, and on the opposite side, it's other way around.
Because somehow your biasing scheme, like both would happen, right? Let's say it's permalloy, it also has spin Hall effect, it would actually bias the superfluid, I guess.
No, well, okay, so that depends. Like, if you turn off spin-orbit interactions,
Yeah, yeah, but
it would. Yeah, yeah. But you're right. In fact, there's something even more interesting. In principle, there is also this type of electrical current also couples the torques that injects skirmions. But both skirmions and the winding ultimately they are not conserved. You know, because skirmions could just locally collapse, but okay, the winding will also unwind by the transverse vorticity flow. So vorticity is really the most robust, truly long-ranged transport phenomenon in this case.
Okay, last question here.
So in your example of the Corbino geometry, is the magnetic field in like the frozen configuration, is there time dependence of the electromagnetic, like the magnetization density? And if so, do you have to worry about interactions with the radiative like dissipation or any kind of?
Not really. Those are tiny, tiny corrections in practice. Yeah. So all these kind of Faraday effects and things like that. Okay. You know, if an engineer picks up this problem, eventually those have to be worked out. But you know, especially when the size of the system, you know, is shrinking progressively, those become less important than the exchange correlation effects. And radiative losses, things like that, radiative losses could safely be, at least once the geometry is optimized, could really be neglected. So I would not worry too much about that. It's kind of a technical, something, a nuance.
Thank you very much also for the discussion.